and the bend of open grass widening from the lowlands, chasing the snow up into the mountains on either side. Rain swept over the valley in silver curtains. Inside the tower, I was parched as barren ground. I had looked at every page of Yaga's book and the handful of other tomes that suited my wandering magic, and any other books the dragon could suggest. There were spells of healing, spells of cleansing, spells of renewal and life. I had tried anything with any promise at all. They held the spring festival in the valley before the planting began. The great bonfire in Alshanka, a tall heap of seasoned wood, so large I could see it plainly from the tower. I was alone in the library when I heard a faint snatch of the music drifting on the wind, and looked out to see the celebration. It seemed to me that the entire valley had burst into life, early shoots prodding their way out of all the fields, the forests bursting into pale and misty greens around every village, and far down those cold stone stairs, Kasha was in her tomb. I turned away and folded my arms on the table and put my head down on them and sobbed. When I lifted my head again, blotchy and tear-stained, he was there, sitting near me, looking out of the window, his face bleak. His hands were folded in his lap, the fingers laced, as though he had held himself back from reaching out to touch me. He had laid a handkerchief on the table before me. I took it up and wiped my face and blew my nose. "I tried once," he said abruptly. "When I was a young man. I lived in a capital then. There was a woman." His mouth twisted slightly, self-mocking. "The foremost beauty of the court, naturally. I suppose there is no harm anymore in saying her name. Now she's 40 years in the grave. Countess Ludmila." I nearly gaped at him, not sure what confused me the most. He was the dragon. He had always been in the tower, and always would be, a permanent fixture, like the mountains in the west. The idea that he had ever lived somewhere else, that he had ever been a young man, seemed perfectly wrong. And yet, at the same time, I stumbled just as much over the idea that he'd loved a woman, 40 years dead. His face was familiar to me now, but I looked at him startled all over again. There were those lines at the corners of his eye and mouth, if I looked for them. But that was all that betrayed his years. In everything else, he was a young man, the steel hard edges of his profile, his dark hair untouched with silver, his pale, smooth, unweathered cheek, his long and graceful hands. I tried to make him a young court wizard in my mind. He almost looked the part in his fine clothes, pursuing some lovely noble woman, and there, my imagination stumbled. He was a thing of books and alembics to me, library and laboratory. "She became corrupted?" I asked helplessly. "Oh no," he said, "not her. Her husband." He paused, and I wondered if he would say anything more. He had never spoken of himself to me at all, and he'd said nothing of the court but to disparage it. After a moment he went on, however, and I listened fascinated. "The Count had gone to Rossia to negotiate a treaty across the mountain pass. He came back with unacceptable terms and a threat of corruption. Ludmila had a wise woman at her house, her nursemaid, who knew enough to warn her. They locked him up in the cellar and barred the door with salt, and told everyone he was ill. No one in the capital thought anything of a beautiful young wife making a scandal of herself while her older husband ailed out of sight, least of all myself, when she made me the object of her pursuit. I was still young and foolish enough at the time to believe myself and my magic likely to elicit admiration instead of alarm, and she was clever and determined enough to take advantage of my vanity. She had me thoroughly on a string before she asked me to save him. She had a particularly deft understanding of human nature, he added dryly. She told me that she couldn't leave him in such a state. She professed herself willing to give up her place at court, her title, her reputation, but so long as he was corrupted, honor demanded she remain chained to his side. Only by saving him could I free her to run away with me. She tempted my selfishness and my pride at once. I assure you, I thought of myself as a noble hero, promising to save my lover's husband. And then she let me see him. He fell silent. I hardly breathed, sitting like a mouse under an owl's tree, so he would go on talking. His gaze was turned inward, bleak, and I felt a kind of recognition. I thought of Jerzy, laughing dreadfully at me out of his sickbed, of Kasia below, with the terrible brightness in her eyes, and knew that the same look lived in my own face. I spent half a year trying, he said finally. I was already accounted the most powerful wizard of Polnia by then. I was certain there was nothing I couldn't do. I ransacked the king's library and the university, and brewed a score of remedies. He waved towards the table where Yaga's book lay shut. That was when I bought that book, among other less wise attempts. Nothing served. His mouth twisted again. Then I came here. He indicated the tower with one finger circling. There was another witch here guarding the wood then, the raven. I thought she might have an answer. She was growing old at last, and most of the wizards at court avoided her carefully. None of them wanted to be sent to replace her when she finally died. I wasn't afraid of that. I was too strong to be sent away from court. But, I said, startled into speaking, and bit my lip. He looked at me for the first time, one of those sarcastic eyebrows raised. But you were sent here in the end, I said uncertainly. No, he said. I chose to stay. The king at the time wasn't particularly enthusiastic about my decision. He preferred to keep me under his eye, and his successors have often pressed me to return. But she persuaded me. He looked away from me again, out the window and over the valley towards the wood. Have you ever heard of a town called Parosna? It sounded only vaguely familiar. The baker and Vernik, I said. Her grandmother was from Parosna. She made a kind of bun. Yes, yes, he said, impatient. And do you have any idea where it is? I groped helplessly. I barely knew the name. Is it in the Yellow Marshes? I offered. No, he said. It was 5 miles down the road from Zatoček. Zatoček was not 2 miles from the barren strip that surrounded the wood. It was the last town in the valley, the last bastion before the wood. So it had been all my life. The wood took it? I whispered. Yes, the dragon said. He rose and went for the great ledger I had seen him write in, the day that Wensa had come to tell us about Kasia being taken, and he brought it to the table and opened it. Each of the great pages was divided into neat lines, rows and columns, careful entries, like an account book. But in each row stood the name of a town, names of people and numbers. This many corrupted, this many taken, this many cured, this many slain. The pages were thick with entries. I reached out and turned the pages back, the parchment unyellowed, the ink still dark. There was a faint clinging magic of preservation on them. The years grew thinner, and the numbers smaller as I went back. There had been more incidents lately, and larger ones. It swallowed Parosna, the night the raven died, the dragon said. He reached out and turned a thick sheaf of pages to where someone else, less orderly, had been keeping the records. Each incident was merrily written out like a story, the writing larger and the lines a little shaky. Today a rider from Parosna. They had a fever there with 7 sick. He did not stop in any towns. He was sickening too. A woodbane infusion eased his fever, and Agatha's 7th incantation was effective at purifying the root of the sickness. 7 weight of silver worth of saffron consumed in the incantation, and 15 for the woodbane. It was the last entry in that hand. I was on my way back to the court by then, the dragon said. The raven had told me the wood was growing. She asked me to stay. I refused indignantly. I thought it beneath me. She told me there was nothing to be done for the count, and I resented it. I told her grandly I would find a way, that whatever the wood's magic had done, I could undo. I told myself she was an old, weak fool, that the wood was encroaching because of her weakness. I hugged myself as he spoke, staring down at the implacable ledger, the blank page beneath that entry. I wished now he would stop speaking. I didn't want to hear any more. He was trying to be kind, bearing his own failure to me, and all I could think was, Kasha, Kasha, a cry inside me. So far as I could learn afterwards, a frantic messenger caught me on the road. She went to Porozna, taking her stores with her, and wore herself out healing the sick. That, of course, was when the wood struck. She managed to fling a handful of children to the next town. I imagine your baker's grandmother was among them. They told the story of 7 workers coming, carrying a sidling hard tree. I was still able to make it through the trees when I came, half a day later. They had planted the hard tree in her body. She yet lived, if you can call it that. I managed to give her a clean death, but that was all I could do before I had to flee. The village was gone, and the wood had pushed its borders out. That was the last great incursion, he added. I halted the advance by taking her place, and I've held it since then, more or less. But it's always trying. And if you hadn't come? I said. I am the only wizard in Polnia strong enough to hold it back, the dragon said, without any particular arrogance, a statement of fact. Every few years, it tests my strength, and once a decade or so, makes a serious attempt, like this last assault on your own village. Dvernik is only one village out from the edge of the wood. If it had managed to kill or corrupt me there, and establish a hard tree, by the time another wizard came, the wood would have swallowed up both your village and Zatochik, and been on the doorstep of the eastern pass to the Yellow Marshes. And it would continue on from there, if given the chance. If I'd allow them to send a weaker wizard when the raven died, by now the whole valley would have been taken over. That's what's happening on the Rossian side. They've lost 4 villages in the last decade, and 2 before that. The wood will reach the southern pass to Kieva province in the next, and then, he shrugged, we'll learn whether it can spread itself over a mountain pass, I suppose. We sat in silence. In his words, I saw a vision of the wood marching slow but implacable over my home, over all the valley, over all the world. I imagined looking down from the tower windows at the endless dark trees, besieged, a whispering hateful ocean in every direction, moving with the wind, not another living thing in sight. The wood would strangle all of them and drag them down under its roots, like it had with Porozna, like it had with Kasha. Tears were sliding down my face, a slow trail, not hard weeping. I was too desolate to cry anymore. The light outside was growing dim. The witch lanterns hadn't yet lit. His face had settled into abstraction, unseeing, and in the dusk, his eyes were impossible to read. What happened to them? I asked to fill the silence, feeling hollow. What happened to her? He stirred. Who? He said, surfacing from his reverie. Oh, Ludmila? He posed. After I came back to the court for the last time, he said finally, I told her there was nothing to be done for her husband. I brought two other wizards from the court to attest his corruption was incurable. They were quite appalled that I'd allowed him to live so long in the first place, and I let one of them put him to death. He shrugged. They try to make hay of it, as it happens. There is more than a little envy among enchanters. They suggested to the king that I ought to be sent here for punishment, for having concealed the corruption. They meant the king to refuse that punishment, but settle on something else, some small or petty wrist-slapping, I suppose. It rather deflated them when I announced I was going, no matter what anyone else thought of it. And Ludmila, I didn't see her again. She tried to claw my eyes out when I told her we had to put him to death, and her remarks at the time rather quickly disillusioned me as to the real nature of her feeling for me, he added dryly. But she inherited the estate and remarried a few years later to a lesser duke. She bore him three sons and a daughter, and lived to the age of 76 as a leading matron of the court. I believe the bards at the court made me the villain of the piece, and her the noble, faithful wife, trying to save her husband at any cost. Not even false, I suppose. That was when I realized that I already knew the story. I had heard it sung, Ludmila and the Enchanter. Only in the song, the brave countess disguised herself as an old peasant woman and cooked and cleaned for the wizard who had stolen her husband's heart, until she found it in his house locked inside a box, and she stole it back and saved him. My eyes prickled with hot tears. No one was enchanted beyond saving in the songs. The hero always saved them. There was no ugly moment in the dark cellar where the countess wept and cried out protest while three wizards put the count to death and then made court politics out of it. Are you ready to let her go? The dragon said. I wasn't, but I was. I was so tired. I couldn't bear to keep going down those stairs, down to the thing wearing Kasha's face. I hadn't saved her at all. She was still in the wood, still swallowed up. But Fulmia still shuddered in my belly deep down, waiting. And if I said yes to him, if I stayed here and buried my head in my arms and let him go away and come back and tell me it was done, I thought it might come roaring out of me again and bring the tower down around us. I looked at the shelves, all around them, desperately, the endless books with their spines and covers like citadel walls. What if one of them still held the secret, the trick that would set her free? I stood and went and put my hands on them, gold-stamped letters, meaningless, beneath my blind fingers. Luth's summoning caught me again, that beautiful leather tome that I'd borrowed so long ago, and enraged the dragon by taking, before I'd ever known anything of magic, before I'd known how much and how little I could do. I put my hands on it, and then I said abruptly, "What does it summon? A demon?" "No, don't be absurd," the dragon said impatiently. "Calling spirits is nothing but charlatanry. It's very easy to claim you've summoned something that's invisible and incorporeal. The summoning does nothing so trivial. It summons..." He paused, and I was surprised to see him struggling for words. "Truth," he said finally, with half a shrug, as though that was inadequate and wrong, but as close as he could come. I didn't understand how you could summon truth, unless he meant seeing past something that was a lie. "But why were you so angry that I had started reading it then?" I demanded. He glared at me. "Does that seem to you a trivial working? I thought you'd been set on to an impossible task by some other enchanter at court, with the intention on their part of blasting the roof of the tower when you'd spent all your strength and your working fell in on itself, and thereby making me look an incompetent fool not to be trusted with an apprentice." "But that would have killed me," I said. "You thought someone from court would spend the life of a peasant with half an ounce of magic to score a victory over me, perhaps to see me ordered back to court humiliated? The dragon said, Of course. Most courtiers set peasants 1 degree above cows, and somewhat below their favorite horses. They're perfectly delighted to spend 1,000 of you in a skirmish with Rosia for some minor advantage on the border. They'd hardly blink at this. He waved the viciousness of it aside. In any case, I certainly didn't expect you to succeed. I stared at the book on the shelf under my hands. I remembered reading it, that sense of pure satisfaction. And abruptly, I pulled the book off the shelf and turned to him, clutching it to my body. He eyed me warily. Could it help Kasha? I asked him. He opened his mouth to deny it, I could tell, but then he hesitated. He looked at the book, frowning and silent. Finally, he said, I doubt it, but the summoning is a strange work. It can't hurt anything, I said, but that won me an irritated look. Certainly it can hurt, he said. Didn't you listen to what I just said? The entire book must be invoked in a single sitting to make the spell, and if you haven't the strength to do it, the whole edifice of the spell will collapse disastrously when you exhaust yourself. I've seen it cast only once, by 3 witches together, each having taught the next younger, passing the book from one to another to read. It almost killed them, and they were by no means weak. I looked down at the book, heavy and golden in my hands. I didn't doubt him. I remembered how I'd liked the taste of it on my tongue, the way it had pulled at me. I drew a deep breath and said, Will you cast it with me? Chapter 10. We chained her first. The dragon carried down heavy iron manacles, and with an incantation thrust one end of them deep into the stone walls of the chamber, while Kasha, the thing inside Kasha, stood back and watched us, unblinking. I held a ring of fire around her, and when he was done, I herded her over, and with another spell, he forced her arms into the manacles. She resisted, more to have the pleasure of putting us to the trouble than out of any worry, I thought. Her expression remained that same inhuman blankness all along, and her eyes never left my face. She was thinner than she had been. The thing ate only sparingly, enough to keep Kasha alive, not enough to keep me from watching her wear away, her body growing gaunt, and her face hollow-cheeked. The dragon conjured a narrow wooden stand and set the summoning upon it. He looked at me. Are you ready? He asked me, in stiff and formal tones. He had dressed in fine garments of silk and leather and velvet, in endless layers, and he wore gloves, as though armoring himself against anything like what had happened the last time we'd cast a working together. It seemed to me as long ago as a century, and as distant as the moon. I was untidy in homespun, my hair pulled into a haphazard knot just to keep it out of my eyes. I reached down and opened the cover, and began to read aloud. The spell caught me up again almost at once, and by now I knew enough of magic to feel it drawing on my strength. But the summoning didn't insist on tearing away chunks of me. I tried to feed it, as I did most of my spells, with a steady, measured stream of magic instead of a torrent, and it permitted me to do so. The words no longer felt so impenetrable. I still couldn't follow the story or remember one sentence to the next, but I began to have the feeling that I wasn't meant to. If I could have remembered, at least some of the words would have been wrong, like hearing again a half-remembered favorite tale from childhood and finding it unsatisfying, or at least not as I'd remembered it. And that was how the summoning made itself perfect, by leaving in that golden place of vague and loving memory. I let it flow through me, and when I finished the page I stopped and let the dragon take it up. He'd insisted grimly He'd read 2 to my 1, when I wouldn't be dissuaded from trying. His voice sounded the words a little differently than I had, with crisper edges and less of a running rhythm, and it didn't feel quite right to me at first. The working continued to build without any difficulty, as far as I could tell, and by the end of his 2 pages, his own reading did sound well to me after all, as though I were hearing a gifted storyteller tell a different version of a tale than the one I loved, and he had overcome my instinctive annoyance at hearing it told differently. But when I had to begin again myself, I struggled to pick up the thread of it, and it was a greater effort than the first page had been. We were trying to tell the story together, but pulling it different ways. I realized in dismay, even as I read, that it wasn't going to be enough that he was my teacher. Those 3 witches he'd seen cast a spell must have been more like one another, in their magic and their working, than he and I were. I kept reading, pushing onward, and I managed to reach the end of the page. When I had finished it, the story was flowing smoothly for me again, but only because it had become my story again, and when the dragon began to read this time, the jarring was even worse. I swallowed against my dry, parched mouth and looked up from the podium, and Kasha was looking at me from the wall where she was chained, smiling with a hideous light in her face, with delight. She could tell as easily as I could that it wasn't good enough, that we couldn't complete the working. I looked at the dragon reading grimly on, intently focused on the page, his brows drawn hard together. He had warned me he would halt the working before we went too deep. If he thought we couldn't succeed, he would try and collapse the spell as safely as he could and control the damage it would do. He had only agreed to try when I had agreed to accept his judgment, and to stop my part of the working and keep out of his way if he felt it necessary to do so. But the working was already strong, full of power. We'd both had to exert ourselves just to keep going. There might already be no safe way. I looked at Kasha's face and remembered the feeling I'd had that the presence in the wood, whatever it was in her, that it was the same presence. If the wood was here in Kasha, if it knew what we were doing and knew that the dragon had been injured, some great part of his strength drained, it would strike again, right away. It would come again for Dvernik, or maybe just Zatochik, settling for a smaller gain. In my desperation to save Kasha, in his pity for my grief, we had just handed the wood a gift. I groped for something to do, anything, and then I swallowed my own hesitation and reached out with a shaking hand to cover his where he held the page down. His eyes darted towards me, and I took a breath and began to read along. He didn't stop, although he glared at me ferociously. "What do you think you're doing?" But after a moment, he understood and caught the idea of what I was trying to do. Our voices sounded terrible at first, when we tried to bring them together, off-key and grating against each other. The working wobbled like a child's tower made of pebbles. But then I stopped trying to read like him, and simply read with him instead, letting instinct guide me. I found myself letting him read the words off the page, and with my own voice, almost making a song of them, choosing a single word or line to chant over again twice or 3 times, sometimes humming instead of words, my foot tapping to give a beat. He resisted at first, holding for a moment to the clean precision of his own working, but my own magic was offering his an invitation, and little by little he began to read, not any less sharply, but to the beat I gave. He was leaving room for my improvisations, giving them air. We turned the page together and kept on without a pause, and halfway down the page, a line flowed out of us that was music, his voice crisply carrying the words while I sang them along, high and low, and abruptly, shockingly, it was easy. His hand had closed on mine, tightly. Our fingers were interlaced, and our magic also. The spell came singing out of us, effortless as water running downhill. It would have been harder to stop than to keep going. And I understood now why he hadn't been able to find the right words, why he hadn't been able to tell me whether the spell would help Kasha or not. The summoning didn't bring forth any beast or object, or conjure up some surge of power. There was no fire or lightning. The only thing it did at all was fill the room with a clear, cool light, not even bright enough to be blinding. But in that light, everything began to look, to be different. The stone of the walls grew translucent, white veins moving like rivers, and when I gazed at them, they told me a story. A strange, deep, endless story, unlike anything human. So much slower and farther away that it felt almost like being stone again myself. The blue fire that danced in its stone cup was in an endless dream, a song circling on itself. I looked into its flickering and saw the temple where that fire had come from, a long way from here, a long since fallen into ruin. But nevertheless, I knew suddenly where that temple stood, and how I could cast that very spell and make a flame that would live on after me. The carved walls of the tomb were coming alive, the inscriptions shining. If I looked at them long enough, I would be able to read them, I was sure. The chains were rattling. Kasha was struggling against them now, furiously, and the noise of the iron links against the wall would have been a horrible noise if the spell had left room for it. But the scraping was muffled into a mild rattling, somewhere far away, and it didn't distract me from the spell. I didn't dare look at her, not yet. When I did, I would know. If Kasha was gone, if there was nothing left of her, I would know. I stared at the pages, too afraid to look, while we kept on chanting. He lifted each one halfway, I took it, and carefully finished turning it. The sheaf of pages under my hand grew and grew, and still the spell poured out of us, and finally I lifted my head, my belly tight, to look at her. The wood stared back at me out of Kasha's face, an endless depth of rustling leaves, whispering hatred and longing and rage. But the dragon posed. My hand had clenched on his. Kasha was there, too. Kasha was there. I could see her, lost and wandering in the dark forest, her hands groping ahead of her, her eyes staring without seeing as she flinched away from branches that slapped in her face, thorns that drank blood from deep scratches on her arms. She didn't even know she wasn't in the wood anymore. She was still trapped, while the wood tore at her little by little, drinking up her misery. I let go of him and stepped towards her. The working didn't fail. The dragon kept on reading, and I kept feeding my magic to the spell. Kasha, I called, and cupped my hands before her face. The light of the spell pulled in them, a brilliant, sharp, terrible white light, hard to bear. I saw my own face reflected in her wide, glassy eyes, and my own secret jealousies, how I had wanted all her gifts, if not the price she would have to pay for them. Tears crept into my eyes. It felt like Wensa haranguing me all over again, and this time there was no escape. All the times I'd felt like nothing, the girl who didn't matter, that no lord would ever want. All the times I'd felt myself a gangly, tangled mess beside her. All the ways she'd been treated specially. A place set aside for her. Gifts and attention lavished. Everyone taking the chance to love her while they could. There had been times I had wanted to be the special one. The one everyone knew would be chosen. Not for long, never for long. But now that seemed like cowardice. I'd enjoyed the dream of being special, and nursed a secret seed of envy against her, though I'd had the luxury of putting it aside whenever I chose. But I couldn't stop. The light was reaching her. She turned towards me, lost in the wood. She turned towards me, and in her face I saw her own deep anger. An anger years long. She'd known all her life she was going to be taken, whether she wanted it or not. The terror of a thousand long nights stared back out at me, with her lying in the dark, wondering what would happen to her, imagining a terrible wizard's hands on her and his breath on her cheek. And behind me, I heard the dragon draw in a sharp breath. He stumbled over the words and halted. The light pulled in my hands flickered. I threw a desperate look back at him, but even as I did, he took up the spell again, his voice rigidly disciplined, his eyes fixed on the page. The light shone through him entirely, as though he'd somehow made himself clear as glass, emptied himself of thought, of feeling, to carry on the spell. Oh, how I wanted to do that. I didn't think I could. I had to turn back to Kasha, full of all my messy, tangled thoughts and secret wishes. And I had to let her see them, see me, like an exposed, pale, squirming worm from under an overturned log. I had to see her, bare before me, and that hurt even worse, because she'd hated me too. She'd hated me for being safe, for being loved. My mother hadn't set me to climb two tall trees. My mother hadn't forced me to go 3 hours walk every day, back and forth, to the hot sticky bakery in the next town, to learn how to cook for a lord. My mother hadn't turned her back to me when I'd cried and told me I had to be brave. My mother hadn't brushed my hair 300 strokes a night, keeping me beautiful, as though she wanted me taken, as though she wanted a daughter who would go to the city and become rich and send back money for her brothers and sisters, the ones she let herself love. Oh, I hadn't even imagined that secret bitterness as sour as spoiled milk. And then, she'd even hated me for being taken. She hadn't been chosen after all. I saw her sitting at the feast afterwards, out of place, everyone whispering. She had never imagined herself here, left behind in a village, in a house that hadn't meant to welcome her back. She'd made up her mind to pay the price and be brave. But now there was nothing left to be brave for, no glittering future ahead. The older village boys smiled at her with a kind of strange, satisfied confidence. Half a dozen of them had spoken to her during the feast, boys who'd never said a word to her, or had only looked at her from afar as though they didn't dare to touch, now came and spoke to her familiarly, as if she had nothing to do but sit there and be chosen by someone else instead. And I'd come back in silk and velvet, my hair caught in a net of jewels, my hands full of magic, the power to do as I liked. And she thought, that should be me. It should have been me, as though I was a thief who'd taken something that belonged to her. It was unbearable. And I saw her recoil from it too, but somehow we had to bear it. Kasha, I called to her, choked out, and held the light steady for her to see. I saw her stand there, hesitating a moment longer, and then she came stumbling towards me, hands reaching forward. The wood tore at her as she came though, branches clawing and vines tangling around her legs, and I could do nothing. I could only stand there and hold the light, while she fell and struggled up again and fell again, terror rising in her face. Kasha, I cried. She was crawling now, still coming, her jaw set with determination, leaving a bloody trail on the fallen leaves and dark moss behind her. She grabbed at roots and pulled herself forward, even while the branches lashed her back, but she was still so far away. And then I looked back up at her body, at her face inhabited by the wood, and it smiled at me. She couldn't escape. The wood was deliberately letting her try, feasting on her very courage, on my own hope. It could drag her back at any moment. It would let her come close enough to see me, maybe even to feel her own body, the air on her face. And then, vines would spring up and lash around her. A storm of falling leaves would shroud her, and the wood would close up around her again. I moaned a protest, and I almost lost the thread of the spell. And then the dragon said behind me, his voice strange and remote, as though he spoke from far away. Agnieszka.
The purging. Ulajistus.
Try it. I can finish alone. I carefully drew my magic back from the summoning. Carefully, carefully, like tipping up a bottle without letting it drip down the neck. The light held, and I whispered, Ulajistus. It was one of the dragon spells, not the kind that came to me easily. I didn't remember the rest of the words he'd said over me. But I let the word roll over my tongue, shaping it carefully, and remembered the feeling of it, the fire that had burned in my veins, the terrible sweetness of the potion on my tongue.
Ulajistus, I said again, drawing it out slowly. Ulajistus,
and made each syllable a small spark struck on tinder, a scrap of magic flying out. And inside the wood, I saw a thin trail of smoke going up from one patch of the undergrowth closing around Kasia. I whispered, Ulajistus, to it, and to another thread of smoke that rose ahead of her. And when I did it to the third, a tiny struggling yellow flame bloomed near her grasping arm.
Ulajistus, I said to it again, giving it another bit of magic, like laying scraps of kindling to a new fire in a dead hearth.
The flame grew stronger, and where it touched, the vines recoiled, pulling back.
Ulajistus, Ulajistus, I chanted, feeding it, building it higher.
And as it climbed, I took burning branches from it and set the rest of the wood alight. Kasia struggled up, pulling her arms free of smoking vines, her own flesh marked pink with the heat. But she could move quicker again, and she came towards me, through the smoke, through the crackling leaves running as the trees went up, as scorching branches fell around her. Her hair was burning, and her torn clothing, tears running down her face as her skin reddened and blistered. Her body before me was jerking in the manacles, writhing in a scream of rage, and I wept and shouted, Ulajistus, again. The fire was growing, and I knew that just as the dragon might have killed me, purging me of the shadows, Kasia might die here now, might burn to death at my hands. I was grateful now for the long, terrible months trying to find something, anything. I was grateful for all the failures, for every minute I had spent here in this tomb with the wood laughing at me. It gave me the strength to keep the spell going. The dragon's voice was steady behind me, an anchor, chanting to the end of the summoning. Kasia was coming near, and all around her the wood was burning. I could see very little of the trees now. She was close enough that she was looking out of her own eyes, and there were flames licking at her skin, roaring, crackling. Her body arched against the stone, thrashing. Her fingers stiffened, going wide, and suddenly her veins ran brilliant green in her arms. Drops of sap burst trickling from her eyes and nose and rivulets down her face like tears, the bright, fresh, sweet smell, horribly wrong. Her mouth hung open in a silent, round cry, and then tiny white rootlets crept out from beneath her nails, like an oak tree growing overnight. They climbed with sudden horrible speed all over the manacles, hardening into gray wood even as they went, and with a noise like ice breaking in midsummer, the chains broke.
I did nothing. There was no time to do anything. It happened quicker than I could even see it. One moment, Kasia was chained. The next, she was leaping for me. She was impossibly strong, flinging me to the ground. I caught her shoulders and held her off with a scream. Sap was running from her face, staining her dress, and it fell on me with a pattering like rain. It crawled over my skin, beating up against my protection spell. Her lips peeled back from her teeth in a snarl. Her hands closed around my throat like brands, hot, burning hot, and those strangling rootlets began to crawl over me. The dragon was chanting faster, running through the final words, racing to the end of the spell. I strangled out, "Eulagistus," again, looking up into the wood and into Kasha's face, twisting half in rage and half in agony as her hands tightened. She stared down at me. The light of the summoning was brightening, filling every corner of the room, impossible to evade. And we looked full into each other. Every secret petty hate and jealousy laid open. And tears were mingling with the sap on her face. I was weeping too, tears sliding from my eyes, even as she pressed the air out of me and darkness started to creep in over my sight. She said, strangled, "Nyeshka," in her own voice, shuddering with determination. And one by one, she forced her fingers open and away from my throat. My vision cleared, and looking into her face, I saw the shame falling away. She looked at me with fierce love, with courage. I sobbed again, once. The sap was running dry, and the fire was consuming her. The little rootlets had withered and crumbled to ash. Another purging would kill her. I knew it. I could see it. And Kasia smiled at me, because she couldn't speak again, and lowered her head in a single slow nod. I felt my own face crumpling and ugly and wretched, and then I said, "Eulagistus." I looked up into Kasia's face, hungry for one last sight of her, but the wood looked out of her eyes at me. Black rage, full of smoke, burning, roots planted too deep to uproot. Kasia still held her own hands away from my throat. And then, the wood was gone. Kasia fell upon me. I screamed with joy and threw my arms around her, and she clutched at me, shaking, sobbing. She was still feverish, her whole body trembling, and she vomited onto the floor, even as I held her, crying weakly. Her hands hurt me. They were scorching hot and hard, and she clung to me too tight, my ribs creaking painfully under my skin. But it was her. The dragon closed the book with a final heavy thump. The room was full of blazing light. There was nowhere for the wood to hide. It was Kasia, and only Kasia. We had won. Chapter 11. The dragon was strange and silent afterwards, as we wrestled Kasia slowly and wearily up the stairs. She was almost insensible, jerking out of a daze only to claw the air before subsiding again. Her limp body was unnaturally heavy, heavy as solid oak, as though the wood had somehow left her transmuted and changed. "Is it gone?" I said to him desperately. "Is it gone?" "Yes," he said shortly, as we heaved her up the long spiraling stairs. Even with his own particular strength, every step was a struggle, as though we were trying to carry a fallen log between our hands, and we were both weary. The summoning would have shown us otherwise. He said nothing more until we had taken her upstairs to the guest chamber, and then he stood by the side of the bed, looking down at her, his brow drawn, and then he turned and left the room. I had little time to think about him. Kasia was feverish and sick for a month. She would start up half awake and lost in nightmares, still in the wood, and she could throw even the dragon off her and nearly across the room. We had to tie her down in the heavy postered bed, with ropes and finally with chains. I slept curled up on the rug at the foot, leaping up to give her water whenever she cried out, and to try and press a few morsels of food into her mouth. She couldn't keep down more than a bite or two of plain bread at first. My days and nights ran into each other, broken with her wakings, every hour at first, and 10 minutes to settle her. So I could never sleep properly, and I staggered dazed through the hours. It was only after the first week that I began to be sure she would live, and I stole a few moments to scribble a note to Wensa to let her know that Kasia was free, that she was getting well. "Will she keep it to herself?" the dragon demanded when I asked him to send it, and I was too drained to ask why he cared. I only opened the letter and scribbled on a line, "Tell no one yet," and handed it to him. I should have asked. He should have pressed me harder to be cautious. But we were both frayed like worn cloth. I didn't know what he was working on, but I saw his light burning in the library late at night as I stumbled down to the kitchens for more broth and back up again, and loose pages covered with diagrams and inscriptions stacked into heaps on his table. One afternoon, following the smell of smoke, I found him asleep in his laboratory, the bottom of an alembic flask blackening over a candle in front of him, already run dry. He jumped when I woke him, and he knocked the whole thing over and started a fire with what for him was wholly uncharacteristic clumsiness. We had to scramble to put it out together, and his shoulders were as stiff as a cat's, disliking the insult to his dignity. 3 weeks later, though, Kasia woke after a full 4 hours of sleep and turned her head to me and said, "Nyeshka." Exhausted but herself, her dark brown eyes warm and clear. I cupped her face in my hands, smiling through tears, and she managed to close her claw-like hands around mine and smile back. From then, she began to recover quickly. Her strange new strength made her clumsy at first, even once she could stand up. She blundered into furniture and fell all the way down the stairs the first time she tried to make her own way down to the kitchens once when I was downstairs cooking more soup. But when I whirled from the fire and flew to her calling in alarm, I found her at the foot of the stairs unhurt, not even bruised, and only struggling to get back onto her feet again. I took her to the great hall to learn how to walk again, and tried to steady her as we went slowly around the room, although more often than not, she knocked me down by accident instead. The dragon was coming down the stairs to get something from the cellars. He stood and watched our awkward progress for a little while from the archway, his face hard and unreadable. After I got her back upstairs and she crawled carefully into bed and fell asleep again, I went down to the library to speak to him. "What's wrong with her?" I demanded. "Nothing," the dragon said flatly. "As far as I can tell, she's uncorrupted." He didn't sound particularly pleased. I didn't understand. I wondered if it bothered him to have someone else staying in the tower. "She's already better," I said. "It won't be for long." He looked at me with bright irritation. "Not for long," he said. "What do you mean to do with her?" I opened my mouth and shut it again. "She'll go home," the dragon said. "Marry a farmer, if she can find one who won't mind his wife is made of wood." "She's still flesh. She's not made of wood," I said, protesting. But I was already realizing, quicker than I wanted to, that he was right. There was no more place for Kasia back in our village than there was for me. I sat slowly down, my hands braced on the table, She'll take her dowry, I said, fumbling for some answer. She'll have to go away, to the city, to university, like the other women. He had been about to speak. He paused and said,
What?
The other chosen ones. The other ones you took, I said without thinking anything of it. I was too worried for Kasia. What could she do? She wasn't a witch. At least people understood what that was. She was simply changed, dreadfully, and I didn't think she could conceal it. He broke in on my thoughts. Tell me, he bit out caustic, and I startled and looked up at him. Did all of you assume I forced myself on them? I only gaped at him, while he glared at me, his face hard and offended. Yes, I said bewildered at first. Yes, of course we did. Why wouldn't we? If you didn't, why don't you just hire a servant? Even as I said it, I began to wonder if that other woman, the one who'd left me the letter, had been right. That he just wanted a little human company, but only little, on his own terms, not someone who could leave him when they liked. Hired servants were inadequate, he said, irritable and evasive. He didn't say why. He made an impatient gesture, not looking at me. If he had seen my face, perhaps he would have stopped. I don't take puling girls who want only to marry a village lover or ones who cringe from me. I stood straight up, the chair clattering back over the floor away from me, slow and late and bubbling. A ferocious anger had risen in me, like a flood. So you take the ones like Kasia, I burst out. The ones brave enough to bear it, who won't hurt their families worse by weeping. And you suppose that makes it right? You don't rape them. You only close them up for 10 years and complain that we think you worse than you are? He stared up at me and I stared back, panting. I hadn't even known those words were in me to be spoken. I hadn't known they were in me to be felt. I would never have thought of speaking so to my lord, the dragon. I had hated him, but I wouldn't have reproached him any more than I would have reproached a bolt of lightning for striking my house. He wasn't a person. He was a lord and a wizard. A strange creature on another plane entirely, as far removed as storms and pestilence. But he had stepped down from that plane. He had given me real kindness. He'd let his magic mingle with my own again, that strange, breathtaking intimacy, all to save Kasia with me. I suppose it might seem strange that I should thank him by shouting at him, that it meant more than thanks. I wanted him to be human. It's not right, I said loudly. It's not right. He stood up, and for a moment we faced each other across the table, both of us furious, both of us, I think, equally shocked. Then he turned and walked away from me, bright, angry streaks of red color in his cheeks, his hand gripping hard on the windowsill as he stared out of the tower. I flung myself out of the room and ran upstairs. For the rest of the day, I stayed by Kasia's bedside while she slept, perched on the bed with her thin hand in mine. She was still warm and alive, but he hadn't misspoken. Her skin was soft, but beneath it, flesh was unyielding. Not like stone, but like a smooth, polished piece of amber, hard but flowing, with the edges rounded away. Her hair shone in a deep golden cast of the candle glow, curling into whorls like the nuts of a tree. She might have been a carved statue. I had told myself she wasn't so altered, but I knew I was wrong. My eyes were too loving. I looked and only saw Kasia. Someone who didn't know her would see a strangeness in her at once. She had always been beautiful. Now she was unearthly so, preserved and shining. She woke and looked at me. What is it? Nothing, I said. Are you hungry? I didn't know what to do for her. I wondered if the dragon would let her stay here. We could